I'll call this meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, we have a very ambitious agenda today, although it's dealing simply with one bill. Just to lay out the plan here, we do have a lot of testimony to hear today. There are amendments. I think all of the amendments that have been offered are in the members' packets, as well as some sort of alternative proposals that have been floated by some of the utilities that are not exactly in the form of amendments, but something to digest. My intention today is to have the bill introduced, hear all of the testimony, including discussion of the amendments, but since there are a lot of issues surrounding this proposal, what we're going to do is at the end of this hearing lay the bill over until next Monday, at which time we will act on amendments and on the bill. I wanted to make sure that everyone who wants to be heard had an opportunity to be heard, and also that members had time to digest the information that we'll get today, as well as the proposed amendments. So it's not my intention to vote on anything today, just to inform ourselves as best we can. With that, since the bill before us, Representative Hillstrom's bill, deals, among other things, with the question of interim rates, I thought that it was appropriate, and Public Utilities Commission staff has graciously agreed to give us a little bit of an overview of the interim rate process, and that's what we will start with. So as soon as we get through that overview, we will take up the Hillstrom bill. Mr. Haar, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission.
Mr. Haar, I don't think we have sound at this point. I don't think the mics are on.
No mics.
Nobody.
Speak up.
I guess we're dealing with that.
I'll need to speak up. All right. I can do that.
I don't think we can start without capability of recording that proceeding.
Oh, that's right.
I guess we could have a little chat, maybe.
Did you hear the one?
Do you know what the problem is?
Just, I was just kind of mumbling to myself that we need to come back. Last time I looked at the schedule, yeah, it was a little hard to tell. There was a couple of those telco bills, but communication related.
Oh, water. That's what's in there.
That's what I have.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Excellent. Mr. Brenner, thank you. Mr. Haar, let's try that again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Once again, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. And with me is Janet Gonzalez, who is the manager of the Energy Rates Unit. And I'd also like to introduce Mr. Dan Wolf, who's sitting in the audience up here. He has just joined our staff as an executive assistant working primarily in the energy of, in the area of policy matters. We were asked.
Sir, I hope that's an addition rather than a replacement, considering the staffing.
It is indeed.
Problems.
It is indeed. We have prepared some slides. You should have a copy of them, just to give you kind of a quick overview of how interim rates are set and sort of the context in which they are set presently. We hope these are helpful to you. The statutory responsibilities of the commission go beyond just rate making. The first bullet point there on the second slide indicates that that's a major responsibility, but the commission is also charged with the responsibility for approval of major energy facilities and also for fostering effective competition in Minnesota telecom industry. The rate making process is also more than just a general rate proceedings, although those are the main shows. That's where all of the utilities rates are looked at and reviewed and established. But rates and terms of service, tariff conditions, and so on can be dealt with through miscellaneous filings of various types also. And also, as you know, there are a number of rate riders that are in effect that also have implications for rates, and that we are presently doing the study that you asked us to do on that, and we'll have that back to you in June. In terms of rate case procedures, because that's where interim rates comes into the picture, the procedures are defined by a statute, 216B.16, and there are a number of provisions in that I'd just like to point out to you that I think have bearing on the subject and on this bill. First of all, the utilities decide when to file rate cases. Typically, that's driven by their financial priorities, and it's certainly not necessarily anything to do with the status of the commission's workload, unfortunately. But once the utility files their case, their proposed rate change will go into effect in 60 days by operation of law, unless the commission suspends the proposed changes and takes steps to establish a rate case process. So the commission in that initial 60 days has a number of things to take care of. Number one, it has to suspend the rates if it wishes to proceed with a rate case review, which it does. I don't know if it ever has not gone through a rate case process. Not in my lifetime, anyway. Also, the commission needs to determine if the filing is complete, if all the materials that are required by rule have been included in the filing, and if the record is sufficient to move forward. It also needs to set the matter for contested case hearing, which involves a referral to the Office of Administrative Hearings, who handle the evidentiary hearing process for the commission, and then also establish interim rates. Once the commission sets that in motion, the final decision, the decision on final rates, must be done within 10 months. Looking then at interim rates, currently statute requires the commission to order interim rates within that 60-day period. Because the period of time in which the commission has to take care of these matters is fairly brief, the statute has allowed the commission some flexibility to act in an expedited way, and that's the language dealing with ex parte and without public hearing, which is some of what's being adjusted in the proposed bill. The interim rates under the current statute is a fairly straightforward process, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Typically, the commission adopts the level of costs that the utility has proposed in their initial filing, provided that those costs are of the same kind and nature as allowed in the last case, that there's not some brand new category. And otherwise, the commission pretty much leaves all the other main components of the rate case the same as they were in the last rate case. In other words, in setting interim rates, the commission does not change the return on equity, for example, which is always a major component in a rate proceeding, nor does it change the rate structure or rate design in any way. It carries over the rate design from the last proceeding. Interim rates then compared to the final rates, if interim rates turn out to be less than, if final rates turn out to be less than the interim rates, the utility then must refund the difference with interest to ratepayers at the conclusion of the proceeding. If final rates are more than the interim rates, the utility may recover a portion of the difference. That portion occurs from the date the commission's final order to the point when the new rates are actually implemented. So it's a limited period of time. There are pros and cons to interim rates. The basic rationale for interim rates, sort of relying on regulatory theory here, is that it reduces regulatory lag. A regulatory lag is the period of time between when costs are incurred and the implementation of rates to reflect those costs. Utilities can't change rates like non-regulated companies. The ability of non-regulated companies that face competitive conditions, their ability to adjust rates is limited, of course, by their competition. Non-regulated companies that face that have a significant market share or market power or other sources of market power are less constrained by competition and therefore have some degree of ability to adjust rates in the event that costs change quickly. Regulated companies, however, must get permission before they can change their rates. They have to come to the regulatory body and go through the general rate proceeding. So there is a lag between the time cost conditions change and when rates can be adjusted. Part of that lag is the time it takes utility management to determine when a rate increase is warranted. The rest is due to the time it takes the administrative process that we manage to run its course. And while regulatory lag can have an adverse effect on a utility's financial status, it can also provide an incentive to minimize costs. Another factor is pro, I guess you could say, for interim rates is the fact that because interim rates reduces regulatory lag, they generally are viewed favorably by the financial community. I think it's fair to say that if they were completely eliminated, it would very likely affect utilities' financing costs. Another factor that we note on the slide here is that although ratepayers are required to pay increased rates before final rates are actually determined, which occurs after the full process has run its course, they do receive a refund with interest if those interim rates are higher than the final rates turn out to be. Looking at some of the concerns about interim rates, as noted, part of the regulatory lag is attributable to the time it takes utility management to evaluate the need for a rate case filing. They make that decision, and the commission does not, and reducing that component of the lag could reduce the need for interim relief. Utilities can also offset regulatory lag by the use of forecasted test years, where the test year, the set of costs and conditions they're looking at to base their rates is actually forecasted and looks into the future so that is a way of also anticipating what those costs might be and reducing lag that might otherwise occur. Automatic cost recovery mechanisms, which occur outside of the general rate case process, also help stabilize utility financial status. And finally, typically interim rates are higher than final rates, and in that case, ratepayers are really made whole if they are required if they are required to pay higher rates for that period of time. The next two slides should be slides that look like this. These provide you some data on recent rate proceedings. Well, not all that recent, I guess, actually, from 2000 through 2008. This sheet, this first sheet, the requested interim and final chart, shows you It provides a lot of information, and it shows you for each of the rate cases that occurred during that period, the amount requested, the amount in this, the amount in the interim rate in the red column, and in the green column, the amount that was finally approved for that particular rate case. So this shows you, gives you evidence on sort of how those numbers come in and how they typically occur or how they have occurred over this period of time. And then the final chart, which is entitled granted as a percent of requested, which is a pie chart, simply shows you the percentage of the total requested rate increases during that period, what percent was approved as final and what percentage was denied over that same group of rate cases, same period of time. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll conclude our comments and stand for questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. That's very helpful. Members, we have a very aggressive agenda today, so hopefully you can keep your questions brief, and we will have an opportunity to ask questions further, but for the time being, Representative Jackson.
Thank you. Dr. Haar, I'm referring to this mm-hmm. pie chart. I'm just wondering if denied means denied as requested or just plain denied, because I understand that requests can come in for a rate increase and you may ultimately grant it in whole or in part. So where does the in part fit in here?
Mr. Haar. Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, the entire circle here represents the total amount requested by the utilities during that period. This portion represents the percentage that was actually ended up being approved by the commission, and this is the not approved, I guess would be another way of saying it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick clarifying question and one broader question that for Dr. Haar. The unit on the bar graph is just straight up dollars.
Mr. Haar.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Just want to make sure that I understood that. And then a broader question about comparing to other states generally. Are there any states where any party other than the utilities, whether it's the state's energy policy or regulatory policy or another party, initiate or require initiation of rate cases?
Mr. Haar?
I'm not aware of particularly, I guess, of what's what occurs in other states. I mean, in Minnesota, here we have authority to initiate a rate proceeding pursuant to a investigation of earnings. If the commission initiates an investigation of earnings and determines that a rate case is required, it can bring the utility in on those terms. But in terms of how other states deal with that exactly, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure. I don't know if Ms. Gonzalez has any comment on that. And I don't have any information on that, I guess.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more brief clarifying question. So are there any other states that have utilities come in at a regular timeline where a calendar, rather than utilities' own interests and demand the rates be reassessed to protect customers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, yes, I believe there are states where that happened. Wisconsin used to have a schedule like that, and they may still. I be honest with you, I haven't checked lately, but it was part of a revised process that they adopted a number of years ago, and I believe there are other states to do that as well.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions? Seeing
Thank
none,
you.
Thank you very much.
You.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, the chair will move that House File 2798 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance from which committee it was referred to this division. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2798 was brought to me by the Attorney General's office. And what this bill does is restricts the authority of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to order interim rates. And it also deals with travel expenses and entertainment-related expenses that have been part of the PUC, the rate increase filings. And so with me is Kermit Frichte from the Attorney General's office, and I would like to have him walk you through.
Mr. Frichte, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kermit Frichte, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Attorney General's office. I'm here along with my colleague, Bill Stamos, to testify briefly in support of Representative Hillstrom's bill, and we're also here to answer any questions you may have. I want to talk about the first part of the bill. It's actually the second part in your materials, but it's the travel, entertainment, and related employee expenses. That part of the bill is a bill about transparency. It's transparency for ratepayers, and it's transparency for regulators. Last month, PUC Chairman David Boyd testified in the other body about the finite resources available to both government agencies that participate in these utility rate-making processes. This part of the bill simply requires utilities to disclose travel, entertainment, lobbying, and certain employee expenses if the utility seeks to include them in their rate case. It does not place any limits on what a utility can spend on these expenses. It simply requires that they clearly be disclosed when these expenses are sought from ratepayers. During the past several rate cases, the Attorney General's office spent numerous hours trying to find this information in the utility rate filings. The division that I was working in was involved in that, and so was Mr. Stamets. This isn't an issue of information that's not available. It's my understanding that this information is available. The utilities have it, and so it's not something that's placing an extra burden as far as disclosing these expenses. We've also heard discussions that a Public Utilities Commission document would be a more appropriate place for something like this, but in a time of scarce resources, this is just one more area for a regulator such as a Public Utilities Commission or the Attorney General's office to have to get involved in when they're already spread very thin. The second part of the proposed legislation deals with interim rates. And under the current law, interim rates are, as you heard Executive Secretary Haar testify, they're the general rule in Minnesota rather than the exception. The changes in the bill would make interim rates the exception rather than the general rule. The recent cases, and I believe you have a handout on this, in 2008, the difference between interim rates and final rates was $68,540,000. And to echo Dr. Haar's comments, the utility controls when they come in for a rate case, and they can use test years to determine these are the expenses that they will be incurring. It's not just expenses that as they are incurred. Mr. Bill Stamets is another Assistant Attorney General who's part of our office that deals extensively with utilities, and either one of us would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Attorney General's office, you're taking away then the ability of the PUC to set rates. Is that what you're asking here in this bill,
Mr. Frichte?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we're not.
What is the purpose of the bill then,
Mr. Frichte?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the purpose of the bill is to require the utility to demonstrate that there are exigent circumstances necessary to allow the granting of interim rates.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
And you're saying that they don't do that now?
Mr. Frichte.
Mr. Chair, Representative, now interim rates, they don't require the exigent circumstances to have the interim rates granted. I'll let Mr. Stamets continue that answer.
Thank you, Chair Hilty, Representative Anderson, Bill Stamets with the Office of the Attorney General. Again, this
this bill relates to the interim rates only. Of course, the commission has the authority to set and authorize final just and reasonable rates. This bill is making interim rates the exception rather than the rule. If the utility can demonstrate that there is a need for interim rates, such a need that they cannot await the normal process that is required to determine just and reasonable final rates, then the utility can make that showing. This bill certainly does not take any authority away from the commission to set rates, final, just, and reasonable rates. That's the commission's role.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stammen, then you found negligence on the part of the PUC in setting interim rates, the fact that they've been doing discriminatory type setting of interim rates against the people in the state of Minnesota?
I think Representative Billstrom wanted to respond to that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, it isn't that. It's if you look at the pie chart, of the rates that were requested, only 64% were finally granted. So what's happening is as the budgets of our homeowners and our businesses have been going up, you know, as the economy has been getting worse, our ratepayers have been paying for costs that then the PUC doesn't approve. And the utility companies will come in and say, yes, but we pay your homeowners and your business owners back with interest. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they pay back with a very low interest rate. Your homeowners and businesses, for example, at many of these utilities, if they pay their utility bill late, they're being charged like 18% on their utility bill if they pay their company late. But your utility companies are charging our homeowners and our businesses first, then the PUC is only approving 64% of it. They have to pay it back to our homeowners and businesses, but they only have to pay it back at a very low interest rate. So what's happening is $68 million in 2008 was essentially borrowed from our constituents and business owners and then paid back at a very low rate when, in fact, our business owners and homeowners were paying a very high rate if they didn't pay their bill. And so this just says that, in fact, you have to prove first that you need the money before you get to charge homeowners and businesses in the interim. You're going to get the rate approved once you prove you need it, but you don't get to charge this amount in the interim until you've proven it.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Hillstrom, do you have, is there something that demonstrates the fact that there's been a gouging of the public?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if you look at the PUC's pie chart, what they're saying is that they have only approved 64% of what's been asked for. And if you look at the chart that we passed out, in 2008 alone, it looks just like this. In 2008, the difference between the interim rate hikes that was asked for and the final rate hikes was more than $68 million. And so what happened is essentially, your homeowners and your businesses gave these rates, paid these rates, and they were told, well, we'll give it back to you after at a very low interest rate. I think it's about 3%. Is that correct? About 3%. In the meantime, if our homeowners and businesses actually didn't pay their bill, they were being charged about 18% in many instances.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. Have you put any money in a bank savings account lately?
Representative Hillstrom.
Actually, no, I haven't. My husband has been out of work, and he got a job today. He's on his way to Green Bay, Wisconsin, but in the last year, have not.
Well, congratulations on your husband.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations on the job. I hope he's not working for the Packers. If you put money in a bank right now, I think you're going to get interest about 1%, maybe a little less than 1%. So I have a little investment tip for everybody in the crowd. Give your money to a utility. Let them return you 3% after a year. Look at the stock market. Look at some other things. 3% doesn't sound like a bad return on people's money right now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. However, Representative Hoppe, if your business and your homeowner can't pay the bill, they are being charged 18% interest on money that company's not even entitled to get.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. We don't know, the utility doesn't know, the PUC doesn't know that they're entitled or not entitled to get it. And if your issue with being charged 18%, if that's your issue and that's a problem, that seems like an entirely different issue. It seems like you're trying to bring this bill forward to solve a different problem.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, what I'm saying is I think that they should have to prove they need the money before they get to take it from our businesses and homeowners. That's it.
Further questions at this time? Representative Kalin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Representative Hoppe and I had a good conversation last year on a directive that became law and actually worked out, but the relating to incentives for utilities on within their rates. It was a docket that was proceeding at the PUC to make energy efficiency a viable and financially viable endeavor for utilities. But I do remember the Representative Hoppe that you and I have shared this concern about rates and about, you know, how do we make sure that we protect our customers. And so I hope that we can continue to focus on that conversation, because I know that there's real concern. I know that that's why the Attorney General's office brought forward this bill and Representative Hillstrom's in front of us with it. But a question for Mr. Stamets or Mr. Fricke, is how many riders do you know are in our statute or in our regulatory policy that allow utilities to go outside of the rate case and you know, thus bypass this interim rate case situation?
Mr. Stamets.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I am aware of approximately 20 rate riders that are authorized by statute.
And so, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stamets, I just want to be clear that when we're allowing utilities to use cost recovery or other riders that are out there, there's no protection whatsoever for through the rate process. Is that correct?
Mr. Stamets.
That is correct. Automatic, those cost riders are automatic pass-throughs. They are not thoroughly vetted like the other costs would be in a rate case proceeding.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Stamets, does the Attorney General's office have a position on riders in general? Is there a preference to go through rate cases where you can have public input and interveners, et cetera?
Mr. Stamets.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I cannot speak to that at this point today. I'm here only to support the bill that's before us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I won't belabor this point, but we heard Dr. Haar speak to the rider study that's going on at the PUC to look at the 20-something riders that are out there. And I have to confess, I believe that I wrote a couple of riders myself, or at least one that I can think of in the efficiency bill in 2007. But I think that Representative Hillstrom is raising a very important larger point, which is that our rate structure in Minnesota is broken. Overall, Representative Hoppe's question, Representative Anderson's question, I think questions that we'll hear through the day point to the fact that our rate structure is broken and that we're living in a 1950s or 60s rate system that is not adequately protecting consumers, nor has it aligned the decisions that we have made as the legislature and this governor has signed with our energy policy is not aligned with our regulatory policy. So we have these symptoms, but I believe the disease is much larger, and I hope that we will have an opportunity through this debate to think about how do we look at that overarching problem. I appreciate the Attorney General's office initiative in bringing the bill and Representative Hillstrom. I think that there are some real issues. I've been struggling with whether they are small problems, small indicators of a large problem, or the problem themselves. I'm on the larger problem side today. But I hope that we will all listen for that. And I know that Representative Beard and I share these concerns. We don't share many other concerns, but we do share this concern. I know that most people in this room would probably agree with us. So I hope that they'll address this question as they come forward and talk about your bill, Representative Hillstrom, as well, to talk about that larger picture. Thank you for the indulgence.
Representative Briner, and then Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for any of the testifiers. I appreciate Representative Kalin's broader view, but I'm going to come in a little more narrowly. Dr. Haar, when he testified, commented on that one of the strengths of the interim rates was the effect on that it was viewed favorably by the financial community. And my question to you is, what effect do you think the constraints on the interim rates that you're proposing here will have on the utilities' earnings and financing costs?
Mr. Stamets?
Thank you, Chair Hilty, Representative. There are, it's important to note there are a dozen or so states that have a structure set up where interim rates are not granted as a matter of course. Rather, they're the exception and not the rule. I am not a financial community expert, but it is my understanding that utilities that operate in those jurisdictions are still able to get money from the financial community. They're still able to deliver power safely and adequately. I don't know. Maybe there is a financial expert here today that can testify to that matter. I don't know that there is, but thank you.
I rather expect we'll hear more about that from some of the testifiers. Mr. Frick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the other thing that we heard briefly from Dr. Haar is utilities, when they do control the time of rate filings, they also control what is included in that filing, and they can file a historical year or a test year. So they don't the utility does not have to actually have incurred the cost. They can, for certainty's sake, they can include a test year, and that can eliminate that the uncertainty.
Representative Hillstrom.
We may as well go three for three, right, and have all three of us answer the question. I think you'll hear from the utilities that they're going to argue that it will affect their credit and it will affect their ability to get money. But I think that the Minnesota Power case is an example of how the current system affects how that works as well. The PUC did not grant Minnesota Power everything that they needed, and one of the first things they're going to tell you is that their stock went down, and it did interfere with their ability to get money. So clearly the structure that we already have can have those impacts as well. So I just want you to know that it isn't exclusive whether you do one way or the other. Either process can have an impact on that.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the responses all three of you have given, but it would help us to have some more objective information on that question. To assert that other states have a more constrained process and that it doesn't affect the confidence of their investors is an assertion, and I'd like a little bit more data on that if it's available.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To any the author, any of the testifiers, a utility can go back, or can they can go back to collect from the ratepayers if the final rate is more than the interim rate. In other words, the final rate chose by the PUC Commission, the final rate that they're going to use, is less than the interim rate. What remedy does the utility have?
Mr. Stamets?
Thank you, Chair. Chair Hilty, Representative. To be clear on your question, if the final authorized rates are greater than what was authorized in interim rates, is that your
That's
question?
Exactly right.
And what remedy does the utility have? By statute, it's 216B16 allows the utility to seek the difference in revenues back to when the Public Utilities Commission authorized the final rates, so they can go back approximately a month or so.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They can go back a month or so if that's the amount of time there has been gone by that they have lost money because the interim rate was less than the final rate. They can only go back a month, or do they lose money if it's more than a month.
Mr. Stamets.
Thank you. Okay, 216B, I'm sorry, 216B, 16 subdivision C. If at the time the final determination the commission finds that the interim rates are less than the rates in the final determination, the commission shall prescribe a method by which its utility will recover the difference in revenues between the date of the final determination and the date the new rate schedules are to put into effect. So whenever they can put in those new rates from when the final determination was made, they can go back that far.
Mr. Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, in other words, if the interim rate was in effect for a year, which is not abnormal, and it was deemed not to be enough, the final rate was not was much more than the interim rate was. They can recover all of that from the utility payers.
Mr. Stanley.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. Only until the date of the final decision, which is not all the way back to the request. No, it's just a month. And, of course, we're talking about an instance that, to my recollection, has not recently occurred. We've not seen a final rate higher than an interim rate in some time, to the best of my recollection. I can't come up with a single example.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to refer you to the chart that was handed out by the PUC. I don't see any on here since 2000 where that was the case.
Thank you very much.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Hillstrom, one of the utilities was in my office yesterday, and we were just talking through this issue. And I asked them, I said, well, what does this mean for the average homeowner? How much would the average homeowner's pocketbook be affected, and how much have you had to pay back, and how much have you overcharged? And the response to me was $1 per month. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, if you're trying to gauge in this economy and with the prices that we've had, the fluctuations that we've had in the commodity prices for energy, and you're trying to pinpoint as a utility where you're going to be and where your costs are going to be, and then you're trying to figure out where your interim rate is going to be at. For them to be within $1 per month or $12 per homeowner per year, to me that doesn't seem like it's extravagant. I was expecting $50 or $100 or some larger number. So I'm just wondering, do the testifiers have any idea? Do you have any other numbers from any other utility that would show that the amount being paid back to a ratepayer is greatly in excess of what I was being told by one of the utilities?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the number that the PUC gave you shows that they've only gotten 64%. So that would mean that even if you gave them the benefit of the doubt and said that it was, you know, 75 cents on the dollar, that would mean for every dollar they charged you, 25 cents wasn't approved according to their numbers. So I can't tell you what that meant to individual homeowners because, for example, you have large company businesses as well. When you have a company who's paying, you know, $50,000 a month on their utility bill, their impact is going to be a lot different than a homeowner's. And so I can't tell you individuals, and I don't know if the AG's office has, I don't think we have any other data, but I can tell you that just looking at the numbers of approved, 64% doesn't strike me as a dollar.
Less than 1%.
Any further questions at this time? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the other part of your bill, and I think one of the testifiers talked about it, contrast that information. How is it available now? If he could just repeat that, or maybe you know, or is it some information that Where would you get it? Is it at the PUC right now, or is it just that they internally have it and they'd have to make it public? And I understand it's the way it's drafted, it's just if they want to recover that. So where would that money otherwise be recovered from if they didn't recover it under their rate case?
Mr. Stamets.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, the numbers are there. The values are there. They're just hidden. And so interveners like the Office of the Attorney General have to ask information requests to get down to the details to determine how much of this rate increase or how much of your rates is devoted towards travel expenses, corporate aviation, food and beverage, these itemized lists here. We have to ask specific what they're called information requests, in which then the utility will respond to provide the detail. What this bill does is say, let's step all that administrative, that problem. It took a great deal of effort on both the utility's part and our part to go through all this data that was given. Let's step through that, and let's just disclose it from the outset. If you want to recover these types of expenses, include it in your initial filing, and we'll examine then whether these are reasonable and necessary for the provision of utility service and whether ratepayers should be paying for these. But don't make us go on a scavenger hunt for the information.
Mr. Chair, the
Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, just the second part. Where does it come out of otherwise? Who pays for it? Does the president just take it out of his salary? Is that what would happen otherwise? Or
Mr. Stamets.
Thank you, Chair. If it's included in rates, ratepayers pay for it. If they get excluded, then the shareholders would incur those costs, provided the utility feels that they are still necessary costs.
Members, I think we need to move on. We have a number of people waiting to testify, and there'll be opportunity later on to question these witnesses. So I would, at this time, like to move on to Mr. Swanson from CenterPoint Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Mr. Swanson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Swanson with Winthrop and Weinstein. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 2798 on behalf of CenterPoint Energy. CenterPoint is the state's largest natural gas provider, providing service to over 700,000 customers in Minnesota. And my testimony today, I'll try to keep it brief, Mr. Chair, given the long list.
I appreciate that.
We'll focus on Section 1 of 2798, the interim rates section of the bill, because this section seeks to bring about a huge change in rate-making policy in Minnesota that would reverse nearly three decades of policy and practice. So I want to discuss briefly why the legislature established the interim rate process in the first place, how interim rates work, and I can probably truncate that because I think Dr. Haar gave you a good discussion of that already, and why dismantling this process we think does more harm than good, both for the state's utilities and for our ratepayers. First, why interim rates? Throughout Minnesota's rate-making statutes, the legislature has focused on the need to balance the interests of ratepayers with the interests and the obligations of the state's utilities. And in fact, the legislative finding that underpins all of energy regulation in the state, 216B01, says, and I'll quote, "It's in the public interest that public utilities be regulated in order to provide retail customers of natural gas and electric service in this state with adequate and reliable services at reasonable rates consistent with the financial and economic requirements of public utilities and their need to construct facilities and to provide such services or otherwise obtain energy supplies." So this idea of balance and fairness, really, you know, weighing what's good for the customer with what's required and what we're imposing on the utilities, runs throughout Chapter 216B. With respect to the rate making process, it shows up in the form of the current interim rate statute. Decades ago, policymakers saw the merit of establishing essentially a hold harmless policy that allows utilities to recover the cost of service during these lengthy rate case processes while still protecting ratepayers. It does it by giving the utility the opportunity of timely recovery for their prudently incurred costs for meeting the obligation to serve while still requiring refunds with interest if the ultimate decision is less than the interim rate level. Why are interim rates needed? For three reasons, at least. Rate cases are long, thorough, extensively litigated, sometimes negotiated processes. They typically, from the time of filing until the actual time of implementation of final rates, take somewhere between 14 to 18 months. CenterPoint's current case, for example, we filed on November 2nd of 2008, and we'll be implementing our final rates sometime later this spring. Throughout this time, though, the utilities retain the obligation to provide safe and reliable service. And the interim rates provide timely recovery, then, of those costs to match the expenditures and offset the regulatory lag that Dr. Haar talked about. How they work, I think Dr. Haar gave a straightforward explanation. The interim rates go in place 60 days after the filing. It is generally a straightforward formula type of calculation based on expenses that the PUC has already approved. But at the same time, it does allow some flexibility in implementing interim rates. And in fact, CenterPoint has used that flexibility in past rate cases, and the commission has approved that, where there have been instances where interim rates have not been passed on to certain customers using the so-called exigent circumstances clause. And then in addition, the current process provides this largely one-way true-up mechanism that Representative Gunther was asking about, requiring a refund with interest if the interim rates overshoot the final rates. But if they undershoot final rates, the utility can't go back except to the date of the final determination. So to give an example, a real-life example, in CenterPoint's current case, it appears that the final rates are going to be slightly lower than the interim rates. And at the end of what will end up being for us about an 18-month process, Representative Welty, I don't think it was CenterPoint talking to you, but the numbers match up. We will likely be refunding to our average customers about $13. The impact of the changes. As I said, rate cases are long, complex, highly contested proceedings. Lots of attorneys, lots of expert witnesses, multiple parties, and it does typically take between 14 to 18 months to run the full process. Again, using our case as an example, the commission has now established just and reasonable rates for CenterPoint with one issue still in dispute that will be decided shortly by the commission. But the commission has now affirmed the reasonableness for 2009. Remember, we filed the case in early November 2008. We filed a 2009 test year. The commission has now reviewed that with one issue outstanding, has said for 2009, CenterPoint has demonstrated the need for a $41 million increase to cover the cost of providing service in 2009. That's what we collected in interim rates. Had we not been able to, that $41 million would have been lost. We would not have been able to match revenues with the expenses we were incurring on behalf of our Minnesota ratepayers in 2009. So what will happen if we do reverse course? One or more of a number of bad results from our perspective. First, rate cases, which are already highly contentious and very expensive propositions to conduct, expenses of which are borne by ratepayers because it's part of being regulated in Minnesota to go through this process, will become even more expensive. And we'll be litigating now the ability to recover interim rates on the front end while we still have to litigate final rates throughout the rest of the proceeding. Utilities will file more frequent rate cases. Dr. Haar mentioned utilities control to some extent, you know, the regulatory lag. By that, what he was referring to is we do control when we file for rate cases. Well, if a utility is knowing that it's not going to be able to see the benefit of any final rate increase for 14 to 18 months. It's going to file more frequently. That's the only way we can control shortening down the window between need and recovering the revenues. And we also believe rates will increase because of the increased cost of capital for the utility, as investors do see a regulatory environment that's become more resistant to allowing timely recovery of our costs. Finally, it can make utilities more resistant at some of the overarching policy considerations that the legislature is pursuing, or more resistant to new investments. If we aren't going to see timely recovery of the expenses associated with those investments or new policy initiatives, the natural inclination is to be more resistant. Obviously, none of these are good results for either the utilities or for ratepayers. In short, we believe the current interim rate process has fairly balanced the needs of the parties involved, has worked well for nearly 30 years now, and we don't see something that's broken and needs to be fixed. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on this matter.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swanson, can you tell me what other states do for interim rates?
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we could spend a long time probably talking about differences in other states. Maybe the best is to focus on some of the states that have been mentioned as making interim rates the exception rather than the rule. The difficulty with making that statement is rate making really is a complex web. You can't pick out one issue in isolation, like when are interim rates allowed, when are they not allowed. Because some of the states that have been mentioned, for example, Texas is a state that CenterPoint has operations in and was cited as a state that doesn't allow interim rates, but Texas provides for a final decision within 185 days. So that's a very different situation than we're dealing with here. Tennessee was a state that was mentioned, but Tennessee provides any number of automatic adjustment mechanisms for things like weather, so there's an automatic true-up, so the utility's made whole. Other states have shorter timelines as well. Other states provide other kinds of adjustment mechanisms in addition to the 20 that were mentioned by Mr. Stamets that make it very, very difficult to draw any conclusion across state lines. And several of the states that have been listed as states that are tougher to get interim rates, if you look at investor information surveys, for example, they'll note that those states routinely award higher returns on equity for their utilities as twos. So you really have to look at a number of different aspects before you draw any conclusion.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up here, if you will, to the previous question and your comment about Texas in 185 days. I was curious, and my original question was, what kind of metrics are in a rate case that require a year and a half? I mean, the complexity, I'm looking for an answer. What's the calculus? Why does it take so long? And when you tell me that it's 6 months in Texas, then I really wonder what takes so long. So can you give me a couple of examples of metrics that are in a rate case that you're aware of that take the PUC 18 months to determine whether you need it or not?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative about
Purcell, I can give you part of that answer. I suspect that Texas has a Public Utilities Commission that's more adequately staffed than the one that we have in Minnesota. Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I like Professor or Dr. Harrell. I think that's an affront to him.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, I think you're maybe on to part of it there. And Representative, I've now litigated rate cases for the past 25 years on behalf of residential and small business customers on behalf of the state and on behalf of large customers and on behalf of the utilities. So I've seen it from every angle possible. In fairness, Minnesota has a tradition of very, very rigorous analysis of these things. There are always issues that can be brought up, explored, litigated. The parties try where we can to work together to negotiate reasonable resolutions. That's part of why you see a lot of results lower than the original request, because the utilities have agreed through negotiation process to accept less. We're looking at the entire expense and investment structure of a utility and the reasonable cost of capital. It's part of the price we pay, I think, to be able to fully explore those issues.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
yes, Paul,
and then we do have to move on.
Yes, I'll be discreet. It just does boggle my mind as to. I understand it. I have a son that's a lawyer, so I understand when you get attorneys involved that you can have long-winded issues. But it just seems to me we're spending an awful lot of the ratepayers' money, the taxpayers' money here, that are receiving this energy. In not so productive a way.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Swanson, you don't have to answer this, but maybe this is just a heads up for the other testifiers who are coming. You operate in other states. In how many states do you get a thorough colonoscopy from the PUC and the Commerce Department and the Attorney General's office? And how are the lengths of those, the entire rate proceeding? Members, we're supposed to have our rate cases done in 10 months here. And part of the Minnesota nice about this whole thing is that the utilities routinely, voluntarily grant PUC 13, 14, 15 months because we have so many people weighing in so intensively on everything we do. I don't know how it is in other states or whether you practice in other states, but to the other testifiers who are coming, I'd appreciate hearing their perspective on how we differ in the intensity of our rate cases from other states.
Mr. Swanson, you have a brief response to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll let others respond because I have not litigated rate cases in other states.
Fair enough.
Thank you. An additional heads up to additional testifiers. I would appreciate it if you would restrict your testimony to things that we have not already heard. I think Mr. Swanson has given us a pretty good overview of a lot of the issue. And rather than go through the same thing over and over, if you could follow some new ground, that would be appreciated. Ms. Hodnick.
Good afternoon, Chair Hilty and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony. I'm Margaret Hodnick. I'm the Vice President of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for Minnesota Power. We provided some advance information for your packets, and I'm planning to go through that presentation, lightly going over the things that have already been covered. I guess I want to make a couple comments, though, on the front end that are not in my packet. One is that I think it's important for people to know that the Commission can order utilities in for a rate case. Utilities initiate rate cases typically, but the Commission has the authority to order utilities in, and I don't think that's been mentioned previously, and I just put that out there.
Actually, I think Mr. Hart did mention it.
Okay, sorry. The first slide in my packet under the basic interim rate premise, I can go over that very quickly. Basically, it is, as Mr. Swanson said, it's to reduce the regulatory lag, and it also supports capital investment because utilities are outlaying large sums of money, millions of dollars, to do capital investment to sustain the current system, to implement new policies like renewable mandates, emission reduction, and that type of thing. So interim rates, at their core, incentivize that investment. That investment and that interim rate fits into a regulatory model, which appears on page 3 of my slides. It looks like this. And I'd like to just walk through that diagram with you. You've got a separate sheet in your packet that indicates the steps that I'm going to walk through, and you can use that for a reference. And with this model, I put Minnesota Power in the middle of it because the utility is in the middle of all these interactions. And if you look at, and my point in going through the regulatory model is to underscore the process in Minnesota. Every state has its process for regulation, and Minnesota has its own process, and that regulatory process provides a balance for all the parties that are concerned to ensure reliable, compliant, continually environmentally improved electric service. And the first step before anything can happen is that Minnesota Power or any other utility has to go to the parties on the left-hand side of your chart, debt holders or shareholders, and raise money to do these capital investments, to get these millions of dollars that are needed to build and sustain utility systems. This capital structure process is regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Once Minnesota Power has the money to do something like an emission reduction project or whatever, our electric facilities, as you see in the center top there, we go to the commission for some kind of a proceeding. It might be a certificate of need proceeding or other, to get an authorization to build this, to have the potential to come and get it collected in rates. And so that process is rate regulated as well, as far as what ends up in rate base and authorization to build things like through certificate of need. And then finally, if you go to the right-hand side, the customers pay for these investments once they're installed and in service, for the most part. And the rates that they pay, any money that they pay, is regulated. So all parts of this process are regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and they all work together. If you go to the next page, on page 4, if you step back from this model and look at it, as I mentioned previously, balance is extremely important in the model. If the model gets out of balance, if it becomes unattractive to invest in utilities in Minnesota, if investment becomes unattractive, we won't have the systems built and sustained the way that we do. We won't be able to meet our renewable mandates that have been passed by the legislature, or do emission mandate requirements this legislature and the federal government have passed. Or rates can become non-competitive, again, if the model gets out of balance, and all the parties are a piece of this. We need those investors. We need that capital investment to accomplish the things that we need on our system that regulators and the legislature has required. If you go to the next slide, number 5, I think there's been some concern expressed about rate cases and why we're starting to see more of them. The main contributors to Minnesota Power's most recent rate case, which was filed this fall, were a federal regional haze rule that are mandating reductions of NOx, nitrogen oxide, and SO2 sulfur dioxide, the Minnesota Mercury Reduction Act that was passed by this legislature, or the legislature in 2005, I should say, Minnesota legislature, and the Renewable Energy Standard, and then our ongoing maintenance of our system. So these are the drivers that are driving rate increases, and the vast majority of the costs in our current rate case, in fact, about 70%, are driven by these types of expenses and investments. Excuse me. Going to slide 6, and utility projects typically cost millions of dollars and have long lead times. They're driven by mandates and system requirements. We have to raise money from investors, and the projects have to be in service before they can be put into rate base to earn an actual rate of return and finally, get into rate base. There are some temporary vehicles like riders that have been mentioned earlier, but they are only temporary. They are not actually part of our rate base until we bring them into a rate case and get them finally ratified. So riders are not a permanent solution for cost recovery. They're temporary. And they were created as an inducement to do certain selected types of projects like emission reduction and renewables. They're not available for all utility costs and expenses. They're targeted incentives that the legislature has offered. The bottom line on this slide is that uncertain cost recovery equals a greater risk to the investors that have provided the money to do these investments. And that makes our cost of capital higher as a utility, and that cost of capital, the cost of borrowing or a devaluing of our stock, will ultimately raise rates because we have to get more money to do the same, have to spend more money to do the same types of investments. So what the regulatory environment does to the investments, investor market, is extremely important because it ends up coming to affect customers in the end. On page 7, you see the $240 million Boswell 3 project. I'll just use this as an example. Again, mandated by the regional haze rule and mandated by the Minnesota Mercury Bill. This project, in effect, had a 10-year lead time, and this is something else I think people need to understand about utility investments. The early years were conceptual. We knew we were going to have to do work there for regional haze and likely for mercury, so we did some studies to look at the best options. The middle years were when we started ordering equipment. Oftentimes, these are huge pieces of equipment that have to be ordered well in advance, not 6 months, but oftentimes 2 years before they're actually deployed. And then the last 3 years, 2007 through 2009, we were doing actual construction of these projects. And my point with this is that we are raising and spending millions of dollars for years, several years, before we actually come to collect it from customers. And the result of that is that that money is put out there before we are collecting it, and it has the project that we completed is delivering the promised emission reductions and the enhanced reliability. But it occurred and was being finished up during the time of the recession that happened. But you have to understand the project started long before the recession happened, and that's the way that utility investment works. If you go to page 8, I want to put this investment in the context of our most recent rate case. We filed it November 1st. It included this Boswell 3 project that I was just mentioning for $240 million. 70% of our rate case was for capital investment. Most of it was for renewables and emission reduction, which again have been ordered by this legislature or the federal government. We anticipated the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission would approve our interim rate request in full based on statutory guidelines and typical practice. And then a full rate case would follow, as described by Mr. Swanson, for 10 or 12 months and an estimated time frame, looking at all the testimony from all the parties and everyone. However, on December 15th, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission allowed only two-thirds of what we requested, and they were concerned about the current economy and rate impacts on customers. That was their decision, and of course Minnesota Power is aware of those concerns of customers, but we started spending these millions of dollars years before this rate case happened, because that's the way these large projects go. Again, they don't turn on a dime. And interim rates have been a central piece of utility stability, financial stability, for these vast capital outlays. Going to page 9, there was an immediate impact on our stock price from that decision. And when I say immediate, I mean within an hour of that decision, our stock price fell. The hearings at the Public Utilities Commission are live streamed on the internet, and investors can watch them and know instantly what the decisions are. And we were asked during the hearing, will this affect your stock price and the investors? And we said, yes, we thought it would, but we had no idea it would be as instantaneous as what actually happened. And, you know, the concern that we share with this is that if the capital markets get concerned about the regulatory environment in Minnesota, and this legislation on interim rates would change one piece of this equation and affect that, the increased capital costs are going to raise rates for customers. And that is why we are concerned about the legislation before you today, because it changes one piece in that regulatory equation. And if anyone thinks that regulatory decision or regulatory policies don't have an impact, if you go to the last slide, you'll see there how clearly and how dramatically our stock fell on the very day that that decision was made. And it started, like I say, within an hour after that decision was made to render lower interim rates than what was typically expected. Our stock price fell, the value of our stock fell by $75 million in 3 days. By the end of the month, it fell by $85 million. Why should anyone care? Well, this means our stock is lower, it's less attractive for people to invest in. We have to sell more of it to raise the same amount of capital that we would want to raise to do investments. And in the end, if our cost of capital goes up, that's going to come back into hitting customers and higher rates. So we're very concerned about legislation that would change or tinker with part of the regulatory equation without looking at the whole picture and what that imbalance can be. And this stock chart just shows you the impact of one decision. It doesn't show you legislation passing and permanently making a change with interim rates. This was just one order from a commission in one utilities case. So I think it's fair to say we have evidence here that there are consequences for changing the regulatory formula in Minnesota. And for those of us who would like to see emission reduction, renewables, transmission, and other investments continue at the pace that they've been going at or at a similar pace, I think we should look very carefully at making any changes to the regulatory equation that are not thoroughly vetted and understood. Thank you, Chair Hilty.
Thank you, Ms. Hodnick. I think we have a couple of members with questions. I have one that kind of hit me as you went through your testimony on the 66% of the request that the commission granted. That, according to what the chart that we had from the commission, that appears to actually have been 2% higher than what they have averaged over the years, and I wonder why you would have expected that your request would exceed what is the historical average.
Chair Hilty, just to make sure I understand, you're referring to that figure relative to what a final rate would be. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, we expected a higher amount for a couple of reasons. One, that's been the practice of the commission, is to grant the full amount, even though the final rate may be a different amount. So the practice has been to grant that full amount. But I think more importantly, the previous rate cases we've had, and they don't appear on the Attorney General sheet, but in years when we've had significant capital investments, like what is represented here, where 70% approximately of our case is capital investment, we've had 70% and even 90% of our final rates, you know, authorized. So to cut back and say, well, it's only going to be 62% when a lot of the money is spent for tangible assets, was just not something that we would have expected. I mean, most of the money in our case is for tangible assets, Chair Hilty. And we also have expenses. We've had a drop in revenues, a significant drop in revenues. That's the other part of our case, the non-capital part of our case. And there, and we expect adjustments and have requested adjustments there as well, sir.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hodnick, I got three quick questions for you here. As the PUC, and perhaps I should ask the PUC this question, but when they're expressing concern about the state of the economy and our homeowners and so on, that's admirable. We're all feeling that pain, and we're trying to live within our own means here. But was any concern expressed about retirement portfolios or retirees who were living off stock dividends that might include Minnesota Power stock? Any thought given to those? Because I know utility stocks are highly sought after by people living on fixed incomes because of that monthly dividend or quarterly dividend.
Yes, Hodnick.
Chair Boyd, Representative Beard. My recollection is that there was no mention made of those individuals, and you're correct. Utility stock owners tend to be retirees and people that are looking for stable fixed income type of investments, and they're not used to dramatic rises and falls. They're not big risk takers, and that's why they invest in utilities, because the environments are typically more predictable, you know, within the regulatory frameworks.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's that word stable again. I'll probably have a little something to say about stability on Monday when we come back and visit this again. But to the next point, the higher costs of money that you incur because of your stock price or because of the uncertainty regarding your rate of return, is that rate recoverable immediately, or is that come under one of those 20 riders that we allow you to apply?
Ms. Hodnick.
Chair Hilty, Representative Beard, it's not recoverable immediately. What it means is that our cost of capital for borrowing that occurs at the time that our stock has been devalued is going to be higher, and so anything we're borrowing for at that time would have a cost increase to it, and when that gets applied for through the rate case process subsequently, that's when it would come through. It wouldn't be immediately. The rate riders are temporary cost recovery mechanisms that the commission will grant upon the presentation of evidence for some particular project, and they exist temporarily. And then when you go for a rate case, if that project is in service and operational, that gets folded into the rates at that time. Representative Beard.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I have one last short question that probably won't get an answer today. In your 2008 rate case, I believe it was, I know your flight department came under scrutiny. And I know my colleagues around this table know me as one of the aviation guys here in the legislature. We've done a very good job of bipartisanly keeping corporate aviation out of the partisan mix, because we understand how important it is to the vitality of a state that's at the end of the road and lives near the Canadian border if we're going to play in a national international market. You probably can't answer this today, but if someone can come back on Monday, I've got a series of questions about your flight department and about XL Energies that I'd like to hear about, because I think 1.2 million of your flight operations were allowed by the PUC after review, I might add, by the Attorney General's office I'm going to ask them about that again on Monday when they come back, Mr. Chair. So you may not be prepared to answer that right now, Ms. Hodnick, but if someone from your company can be back on Monday, I'd like to thoroughly examine that a little bit.
Chair Hilty, Representative Beard, I can tell you that $600,000 was authorized in our last rate case, about half of the amount that we requested.
Okay.
And in the current rate case, that is the amount that we've requested for aircraft is $600,000.
And I assure you, your operation, your flight department is substantially more than that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking forward to Monday, or Tuesday. Tuesday, I guess it is.
Monday.
Okay. See you then.
Chair Hilty, may I please make one other comment? On that 2008 rate case, I just want to point out that we requested $45 million, as you see, and we ended up with $20 million. And our allowed rate of return, and I want to be clear about this because people often think utilities have guaranteed rate of returns, but our allowed rate of return in that case was 10.74%. However, with the drop in what we were allowed in final rates and what our revenues were since that period of time, our actual rate of return has been 7%. So I just want to clarify for anybody who may think that utilities have guaranteed rate of returns that they're not guaranteed, and rate case outcomes definitely have an impact and do not guarantee them at the levels that may be stated in an order.
Thank you. We do have Representative Falk with a question. Before we go to that, members, I think both the Republican and the DFL caucuses have meetings at 4:30. We're going to run up against that. We'll try to squeeze in an additional few minutes of testimony. So if we can't get through the whole lineup, which pretty obviously we can't, we'll just take it up on Monday. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe more of an editorial comment. I do get frustrated with some of these comments about how stock prices fluctuate. And just looking at this, I mean, I think there was a greater market downturn going on, but you know, at the period of time too. So that may be an additional factor. But I've been reading through your 10K report, and there has been issuances of additional stock, and the idea that simply seeing a stock price going up or down, how it translates to the ability to finance, unless you're issuing additional shares, I don't see how that has an impact on your balance sheet. It's just an observation.
Yes, Hodnick.
Chair Hilty, thank you. Representative Falk, it does have an impact on the cost of capital and what we can raise. If you look at that stock chart and you see how we decline, and I'm glad that you brought this question up, sir, actually, because there are two other stock indices on there, a green one and the magenta or kind of red-colored one. Those are both utility stock indices, and you can see during the same period of time they did not fall the way that ours did, nor did that blue line, which represents the Standard & Poor 500. It was Minnesota Power stock that took the big decline, and it has continued to stay down, even though the other stocks continued up until the third week of January when there was a general market decline and stocks came down at that time. However, Minnesota Power has not made up the ground that it lost since that decision on December 15th.
Thank you, Ms. Hodnick.
Thank you,
Chair
Hilton.
Let us move to Chris Clark from Xcel Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do have a handout which might help me shorten my presentation, so let me introduce it that way.
And Mr. Clark, please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chris Clark, and I'm an in-house attorney for Xcel Energy. I managed our recent electric rate case, and I was also directly involved in coordinating the response to the Attorney General's questions regarding expenses and the successful resolution of those issues with the OAG in our rate case. We believe we made good progress on expense issues and resolved them effectively before the Commission. We're not sure additional legislation is necessary, but I'll discuss our willingness to support additional transparency later in my comments. Our main concern today, like the other utilities who you've heard from, is the dramatic proposal to eliminate rates in Section 1 of House File 2798. The proposal is a fundamental departure from our current practice, which would significantly impact the investment path we are on, would change how we do our business, and would slow investment. It's not a small adjustment what's sought by the bill, but a substantial change in the foundation of Minnesota's regulatory structure. Interim rates are an important part of the structure of Minnesota's strong regulatory environment, and that's an environment that's allowed Minnesota to be a leader on energy policy. And just to give you a few examples, and try and short my presentation here, because I do respect the time constraints you're under, that policy has allowed us to support billions of dollars of investment in our energy infrastructure, has allowed us to maintain, at the same time, reliable service and reasonable rates when compared to other utilities nationally, and has helped us achieve Minnesota's important energy and environmental policy goals. We're at a time of dramatic costs as we modernize our system and pursue renewable energy and refurbishing our existing generation infrastructure, such as our nuclear plants and our metropolitan plants. And just to give you an idea, over the past several years, Xcel Energy has invested literally billions of dollars to maintain that system, improve our nuclear, coal, and gas power plants, add wind energy, and reduce emissions. It's staggering when you look at the investments we've made. We're investing and have invested billions of dollars in extending the lives of our nuclear plants. That provides good carbon clean energy for another 20 years. We are investing billions towards wind and renewable energy and the transmission necessary to deliver that energy to the market and to our customers. We undertook the Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Program, a program that couldn't have been undertaken without the tools that the legislature and the commission exercised to allow us to do that, both rider recovery and the rate processes that we have. And finally, we've undertaken other measures to reduce emissions. We've made mercury reductions at our Sherco 3 plant and have recently filed a plan and proposal addressing how we'll address mercury at our Sherco 1 and 2 plant. Interim rates are important to us because they affect our ability to keep going with this strong energy policy that we're pursuing, and has put Minnesota on a strong course to maintain its position as an energy policy leader and to be ahead of the curve in investment. Let me just turn to the handout for a couple of moments, if I could. And you've heard quite a bit about how interim rates work and the process. And the other parties are correct. The reason for interim rates is it allows us to conduct a year-long, very thorough review of all of the costs of our business. This first page is simply an overview of the timeline that we undertake in a rate case. For the commission, I'd like to say the work begins the day that the filing comes in, but the reality is we're a heavily regulated business, and so they see us well before we get there, and there's a significant amount of work that we undertake internally before we actually file the rate case. Once we file the rate case, there's a 60-day period, and then interim rates go into effect, and the chart there reflects that period where we collect the interim rates. To give you an example of how this worked in our last electric rate case, we collected about $132 million in interim rates. The commission ultimately allowed about $91 million in our final rate decision. $30 million of that difference was related to one decision that the commission made that was a change in precedent in how they handled the depreciation expense. If you then adjust for that $30 million, you can see that we're very close. Our rate cases typically run from the about 88% to 90% range of what we're able to achieve from interim to the final rate order. For us, this is revenue that we need to continue operating our business. Without interim rates, we would not have had the $91 million that the commission found was a necessary cost to operate our business and provide utility service. Going to the perspective that the Attorney General offers in the bill, we would simply be out that $90 million. Customers are protected. The existing statute has significant, strong protections for customers. The amounts are refunded with interest. The commission has authority if they believe abuses occur. We don't believe there is a problem here, and certainly to the extent you have concerns about whether the interim and final rates are close enough, there are other mechanisms that I think are outlined in some of the amendments that could perhaps in a more precise way address any concern you might have. Let me turn to page 2 of the handout, if I could, and just show you what Minnesota gets for the regulatory structure that we have. Interim rates, riders, a very thorough and extensive commission process and oversight. This is a chart from one of our expert witnesses in our last electric case. And you can see there are several utilities that are listed there. And on the far right, you'll see NSP Minnesota. You can see that the green line there goes off the top of the chart compared to the other utilities. This is the level of investment that we're able to sustain compared to our peers. You can see that it's significant and dramatic. Taking away interim rates takes away a fundamental piece of the foundation that allows us to accomplish this. It is correct to say that the commission and the legislature have provided effective tools through riders, and the commission has provided the oversight and scrutiny to make sure that our costs remain reasonable and prudent. But the structure has also allowed us to accomplish a significant amount. It's allowed us to be a leader on energy policy. It allows us to make the investments we need to in our aging infrastructure. It's allowed us to be on the front end of addressing the need for emission reductions. Without that level of investment, we'll be with these other utilities. And our view is that these other utilities are going to be behind the ball at the end of the day, and they're going to face those costs at some point. There was a comment earlier that perhaps riders don't get the scrutiny they need to. Our perspective is that riders actually get more scrutiny in some cases than a rate case will provide. That said, we recognize that the combination of rate cases and riders does place a burden on the administrative agencies who oversee these costs. And we agree that it is time to consider whether we reform the entire regulatory structure to address the pressures that we're going to face in this industry as we modernize, as we move to cleaner generation, and as we work to reduce emissions. On top of all that, the distribution system is approaching the end of its useful life. It's been in the ground since about the 1950s, and we've gotten actually more life out of it than we expected, but it's time for us to begin the process of addressing replacing that. Like you face the challenges of budget issues, we struggle to figure out how to prioritize the capital spending, how to make sure what we do what we need to provide the reliable and safe service necessary for our customers, while at the same time trying to keep the overall rate structure reasonable. So far, we think that the utilities, the legislature in Minnesota, and the commission have had a process that's allowed us to get it right. But we think there are opportunities to improve it going forward. If I could just briefly take a moment and tell you about the second two slides. These are the slides that show our interim versus our finally authorized rates in our last four cases in Minnesota. And for us, we think this paints a picture that the number is actually much closer to 85 or 90% of final rates versus interim rates, rather than the 64% that was provided earlier. And like every chart and statistic, you have to dig into the details. And we think when you dig into the details of those numbers, you'll see that that one decision, it's this second bar on the third page here that shows the nuclear depreciation precedent change. That's worth $30 million. So when you look at the materials earlier talking about the $68 million, if you take this one issue out, you're down to $38 million. And we think that brings it much closer to the 85% that that we believe is really what's happened in Minnesota. Why don't I conclude and say that we appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. We're proud to do business in Minnesota. We do look at other states' regulatory structures. We think as you undertake an examination of what the right structure is for Minnesota, you need to heed the comments of some of the earlier speakers that you need to look at the total picture. And so we're happy to engage in that with you. I'll just make one final brief comment. One of the representatives asked about the quality and thoroughness of the process and why it takes a long time. I agree with the previous speaker that the Minnesota process is an extremely thorough review of all the costs in our business that we present to the legislature, or to the commission when we file a rate case. In our view, that process has actually worked well to deal with issues like expenses. When the Attorney General raised those issues in our case, we did work to provide them the information they needed. We did recognize the issue they identified. We appreciated the concerns that they identified, and we changed our policies as a result and worked with them to resolve the issue in that case. So we think there is a high-quality process in Minnesota, and we look forward to working with you and other stakeholders as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Briefly, any questions for this witness, Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Mr. Clark, because I appreciate deeply how important corporate travel is, especially corporate flight departments for Fortune 500 companies like yours. I got just a few questions about that. You may not be able to answer them all today. Perhaps we can get the answers by Monday. A few months ago, there was a rather incomplete report on an investigative report on Channel 5 that kind of sensationalized this whole thing. It must have been sweeps week or something, because to me it struck me as sensationally slanted. However, after complaining bitterly to the reporter involved, in fact both of them, I do have to chide you just a little bit, or your company, that apparently no one was forthcoming to share the Excel side of the story. Now, I happen to know the gentleman who runs your flight department. You run an outstanding company, a great flight department. You have nothing to hide. So to all the companies in the room with airplanes and that you do business with, when a reporter calls, please answer the call. It could be a good thing. And if they end up slanting it and slamming you and making it look like gotcha journalism, call me. I'll be happy to go have a chat with the reporter, and we'll see if we can set the record straight. Having said that, you have a bunch of shareholders that watch over your shoulder like hawks because they like their rate of return and they like that monthly dividend, quarterly dividend, or whatever it is. Do your shareholders question your flight department and the efficacy of what you do when you run a flight department to move your people around the country?
Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I think our shareholders recognize that our corporate aviation department is actually one of the many tools we use to run our business effectively. We use our corporate aviation to conduct our business across a multi-state utility system that includes remote locations, and that includes, quite frankly, significant presence in multiple cities that requires us to move people back and forth. We think that overall structure is a very efficient structure and benefits both ratepayers and shareholders, and both of those constituencies want us to drive unreasonable costs out of the business. So we get the pressure not only from the state, but also from the shareholders.
Well, Mr. Chairman, related to that, knowing what airplanes cost, I don't know how in the heck you got Learjets for $1,200 an hour, but that is a steal. Somebody at your department's on the ball, and the AG, I hope, sends them a thank you card for doing that. Related to that, something I'm just curious about. I know you fly two planes back and forth in a looped cycle, which is a very efficient way to run a corporate aviation department, members. But I'd like to know how many tickets you buy on the airlines in addition to that. You may not be prepared to answer that today, but I'd like to hear that Monday.
Thank you, Representative Beard.
The last question is for the AGs. This is a heads up for them on Monday because they're coming back, and I want to ask them about why they looked at this in the 2008 rate case and basically signed off on the flight department, and now all of a sudden it's a big issue this year. That'll be a question on Monday. Thank you.
Very well. I apologize to the people that were prepared to testify today that we didn't get to, but we will certainly give you that opportunity on Monday, as well as any of the testifiers that did testify today. If you have additional comments, we will entertain those.
Mr. Chair.
On Monday. Representative.
Would Hulk, you entertain a motion to approve the minutes?
I would do that, Mr.
So moved.
Hulk. We have a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted, and the meeting is adjourned.